which is another informational item on the balloon track cleanup. I want to take a five-minute break before we do that. I know there's other people outside that are probably milling around and waiting to do this. So let's do that. We'll make it quick. We'll shoot for quarter after, which is about 6 minutes. Let's really try to be back here by then. Started.
Sorry about that.
No, your hands on Joe Dillon. No problem. Okay. You're ready to get started here on item number 7, our update on the Southern Pacific Transportation Company balloon track site. This is an informational item only. The board's not taking any action today. Our staff will be making a presentation to update our board regarding this site. We will be also taking public comment. The issues surrounding our site are multiple and complex. Our board is, however, only involved in the cleanup of the site, and the issues related to further development of the site are not within our jurisdiction, but rather within the jurisdiction of the county. It's therefore the preference of our board that all comments be limited in scope to the issues related to cleanup and not to those related to the development of the site. And with that, Erin.
Hi. My name is Karen Woodhouse. I'm a staff environmental scientist with the cleanups division in our board. The balloon track, this is what I'd like to talk about today, is the location, history, the cleanup process, investigation, basically what's going on now and what's happened in the past there. The location is well hidden. If you look out the windows, you'll be looking right out on it, so it's very close here. The site history, until about the 1880s, it was tidal marsh. And they in wetlands, and they filled it in at least two separate episodes in the 1880s and also in the 1940s, late 40s. Even before the big fill, there was a railroad run on a berm on the western side. There was also then the expansion of the rail yard operations to include rail car maintenance and repair, locomotive fueling, not extensive operations, but it was a spot where they would do some of that work. There was also petroleum bulk fuel collection and storage sites, locations on the site. They were operated by General Petroleum and also by ARCO. The rail is now inactive, and the tracks were removed sometime in the 90s, and that's where we are now. Here's a nice photo of the filling of the wetlands, and you can see in the upper northeast side of the site, there's already pretty well developed and a lot of operations. And this is probably taken in 1946. And you can see down in the lower right-hand corner, or I'm sorry, the lower left-hand corner, Clark Slough area, which we'll be talking about later, and this operation is starting to fill that area in. And you can see why it was also called balloon track. The tracks made the shape of a balloon. This is one of those 1952 Merrill Schuster photos that are so nice that, you know, resources for Humboldt County. The oblique angle really lets you look at what the operations were in its heyday. You can see the rail car maintenance and the locomotive fueling were in full swing at this point. Let me show you a couple of landmarks on the site that we'll be talking about later. We've got the turntable here. So the cars would pull in, they'd turn them so that they were lined up with the right bay in the roundhouse where the work would be done. Near the roundhouse was an oil disposal pit because that was sort of the work that was being done there. You can also see an above-ground storage tank there. From the early 1900s until about 1954, Bunker C fuel was the fuel for the locomotives, and that was a 650,000-gallon tank. Sometime around 1954, that was cut down to provide secondary containment to two smaller diesel tanks. And if you look out this window a little bit on the left, you'll see the remains of that tank there. And here's the Clark Slough area. You can see it's been channelized. The part that drains the southern part of the site and a large portion of industrial Eureka is there, runs under the road out here and comes out right over here, right next to the Warfinger building.
Karen? We're sitting right up there in the upper right-hand corner of the photograph on that fill pad.
Right here?
Yeah. That's where we are sitting right now?
No, we're sitting right about here
okay.
Right now. And that was used for lumber storage and log storage.
Okay.
So this is what it looks like today. It's currently vacant and inactive. A lot of the features have been removed. Down in this area is where the bulk petroleum facilities are. Here's the Clark Slough. You can see the remains of the turntable here. It's got some substructure to it that's still there. The roundhouse foundation is there. I don't have a current picture of that. The above-ground storage tank is there, and you can see what it looks like now. It's kind of got some nice urban art on it. And here's Clark Slough. It's been channelized. It drains, as I said, a pretty large industrial area. And you can see from the photo it looks degraded, although it still provides habitat that needs to be protected, even in the current state. Just to give you a really quick review, I know you went over this with Casey Ashley a couple of months ago, but I want to put in context where we are in the cleanup on this site. The whole site investigation and cleanup process is guided by California Water Code and also State Board Policy 92-49. We start out looking at characterization, trying to figure out what's going on at the site and evaluating the risks. This is where we get into an iterative issue of looking at looking for chemicals, finding them or not finding them, winnowing our list of potential contaminants. We have to find a balance that's sometimes hard to find here between requiring somebody to look for every chemical every place and doing something that actually is cost-effective. And this is where you'll often find valid disagreements over, you know, whether the nature and extent of contamination has been defined. So after you do that, you move into setting your cleanup goals and remedies. State law requires us to clean up to background if it's technically and economically feasible. And when it's not, the cleanup objectives are based on the environmental conditions and also on the planned future uses. But the goals are basically to protect human health and the environment and the beneficial uses of the receiving water. Then you implement the remedy. And you not only implement it, but you evaluate it. We do confirmation sampling. You evaluate whether you've attained your cleanup goals. And at any point in the process, even after closure, it can be reopened if additional contamination or problems are found. And our role in the process, as Chairman Hale said, is not to get involved in the local land use decisions. This is our role right here. There's currently a pretty lively local discussion over development. And our role is to ensure that the site is cleaned up to protect the beneficial uses and to protect the future uses that are chosen by the community. And we have to look at a cleanup and abatement proposal that would actually achieve those cleanup goals and do it in a reasonable time frame. And we talked about beneficial uses a couple of times. Here's what they are briefly for Humboldt Bay. So you can see it's a pretty long list here, and these are existing and potential beneficial uses. So where we are in the site investigation process, here's basically sort of a chronology of the Regional Water Board role in the site. We issued WDRs for stormwater. We've done some site investigations. In 1996, there was a human health risk assessment, which was later revised in 2000. It followed the federal EPA and California guidance, and it was approved by the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. It showed no significant risk to humans based on a variety of exposure pathways. It did not include dioxins, which weren't being looked for at the time, and it didn't include, of course, eco-risk since this was a human health assessment. 2001 and 2002, we used two of our regulatory tools, a cleanup and abatement order and also a monitoring and reporting order. Under the cleanup and abatement order, we required an interim remedial action plan be submitted later that year, and it was. It resulted in a lot of source removals at the site. And the monitoring and reporting program is ongoing and requires regular monitoring of both the groundwater and the surface water and stormwater at the site. So when we go into looking exactly at, you know, what is being investigated, we turn to the history of the site in which you would expect the contamination to have originated from. And these are the things that we looked at. This helps guide what you're looking for and where you're looking for it. And based on that list, these were the potential contaminants that were looked for. Dioxins and furans were added much later in the process, but we mostly were concerned, based on the history of the site, for petroleum hydrocarbons, metals, oils, polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons. And we found that the primary contamination is the long-chain hydrocarbons and metals, particularly copper, lead, and arsenic. We have, as I said, we have a cleanup and abatement order on the site. It's got a couple of interesting provisions. One, it's a little bit out of date in that it doesn't include all responsible parties at this point because Union Pacific sold the site. So we need to have new owners listed. It also has a provision that says that they don't have to submit a final remedial action plan until 8 months prior to seeking or applying for development of the site. And I believe it was written that way because site development was fairly imminent. And since it didn't occur, we just currently have no set date for a final remedial action plan based on this cleanup and abatement order. So the site investigation work, as I said, was directed by the site history and the prior investigations, but we've sampled all environmental media, soil, groundwater, surface water, and we looked at targeted areas as well as sort of general site coverage. We looked at hydrocarbons, volatile organic compounds, semi-volatile organic compounds, and metals. Borings and trenches for looking at soil, groundwater, as I said, which is also ongoing monitoring, and surface water, which is ongoing monitoring. And here is what the site investigation looks like, although there's more that isn't shown up in this area and some more down in this area also. As I had said earlier, that a cleanup plan is only really as good as the information that you use to develop it. And what you're looking for is something that characterizes a site where you're looking in the right areas, the right compounds, the right medium, the right depth. And that's the balance we're trying to achieve here. The dots there are showing borings, monitoring wells, discrete locations, and the lines are showing soil trenching to look for what was there. And you can see it was focused largely around the operational areas that we've already discussed. But also has some general site coverage. And as I said, there were some interim site remedial actions, mostly source removal actions. They've removed a lot of contaminated soil, some above ground and below ground storage tanks, oily waste, and petroleum impacted water. The soiling sampling activities, there's been over 250 soil samples have been collected for analysis. Over 140 soil samples from the trenches, and there have been thousands of analyses conducted at the site. Ongoing monitoring, we have biennial groundwater monitoring that looks at both the shallow groundwater and the deeper groundwater. There's more than a dozen wells out there. There's also monthly stormwater monitoring when there's sufficient rain to generate runoff at the site. And as you can see from looking at the site, figuring out where the drainage patterns are is a little bit complex. It's relatively flat with, you know, some undulations there. The overall analyte list we looked at in the variety of samples includes, you know, the gasoline or the fuels and the fuel components. You've got your polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons. You've got your metals. You've got your volatile and semi-volatile organic constituents. It was a process of, you know, winnowing down and also adding to the analyte list depending on what was discovered. That's part of the iterative process. And I want to speak specifically about dioxins, not because it's a widespread contamination at the site, but because there's been a lot of community interest in the issue of dioxins at the site. They've been found in depositional areas such as Clark Slough, which is where you'd expect to find them. They went to look for them where you expect to find them, and that's where they were found. The source of those weren't determined. As I said, Clark Slough drains a relatively large area of industrial Eureka, so we do need additional investigation to figure out where the source is. I'd hate to be in a position of requiring a cleanup only to have it recontaminated because the actual source wasn't addressed. Just to give you some context for the levels found out there ranged from about, you know, 15, 16 up to the mid-100, 600-ish. There was one much higher level, but there was a lot of laboratory issues with that one. And to put that in context, the cleanup objectives we tend to use for dioxins are put out by the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. We call them chisels. For residential, we tend to look at like 4.6 parts per trillion. The current EPA cleanup for residential is 1,000 parts per million. They're proposing 72, but they haven't gotten that yet. And the DTSC cleanup for residential is 50. On the industrial side, we tend to use the chisel of 19 parts per trillion. The current EPA cleanup is 5,000 to 20,000. The EPA proposal is 950, and the DTSC uses 200 to about 1,000. So it gives you some idea of the context. I think everybody struggles with the fact that dioxins and furans are toxic at fairly low levels, and they're also very expensive to sample for. And so you're sort of left with another balancing act of how much to require in sampling and then what you do with it once you find it. Another issue that's been of concern in the community is the Supplemental Interim Remedial Action Plan. As I said, we've been requiring them to do stormwater monitoring, and one of the things that keeps coming up is copper. And so we asked for a plan to address the copper. And the responsible party came back with a supplemental remedial action plan last June. And it involved not only the stormwater control, but also other issues that they were rolling together with a development plan, submitting it to the county or to the city. The CIRAP, as it's called, is not a cleanup plan. It is something that we requested to narrowly address the stormwater runoff. We concurred that the plan would address stormwater runoff. We didn't make any findings about whether it would also meet other local or state requirements. We did, in our concurrence, state that, you know, they would have to obtain all necessary permits in order to implement it. It's been, I'm not sure the right word to use, maybe stalled at the Coastal Commission, California Coastal Commission at this point. The Coastal Commission has decided that it will hear the permit, and I don't know what the date is for that hearing. So where are we and what are our next steps? We are going to continue to pursue stormwater controls since it looks like the Supplemental Interim Remedial Action Plan isn't moving forward in a fashion that we'd like to see in terms of stormwater control issue. We're talking about perhaps enrollment in the industrial stormwater program to separate it from the cleanups issue and also to provide a more formal established process for dealing with the stormwater issues. We'd also like to revise a cleanup and abatement order. As I said, it's sort of out of date and incomplete. And we have seen that additional investigation is warranted at the site, and so we'll continue with that. And I also want to make a point that when you're looking on GeoTracker for this site, to get the full picture, you need to look at under two case numbers, and those are up there. Are there any questions?
Thanks, Karen. Any board member questions?
Mr. Chair, may I?
Master Rourke.
Karen, thank you. 29 days a month, I'm a consultant that deals with this very thing, so I can appreciate much of what you've gone through here. Some basic questions first. Is this site laterally and vertically defined with the constituents' concerns that you've identified here?
There is a lot of information about the depth of the constituents and the depth of contamination. As I said, there are two aquifers on the site, a shallow one that doesn't seem to be in contact with the bay, with the tidal influence, and a lower one. And the contamination of the groundwater seems like it's fairly limited in scope. It doesn't seem to be migrating, and it seems to be on a downward trend. The only, let me find a different picture. There is still significant contamination for petroleum hydrocarbons in one of the monitoring points in this area in groundwater, in the A zone, in the upper level, and over in this area also where the storage tank was.
And is it correct, at least preliminarily, it looks like this investigation started in 1988, so we're talking a period of approximately 22 years. Given groundwater concentrations over time, have you seen decreases
yes.
in this concentration over time, or are we getting close to closure levels on the groundwater side?
The groundwater side, there's been a definite downward trend. We see a lot of the analyses are below our water quality objectives. The ones that jump out are the ones where I pointed out over in the bulk petroleum area and also over in this area. I think a lot of the source removals that were done earlier helped that issue.
Okay. And from that standpoint, constituents are concerned. It's heavy-range hydrocarbons, a variety of metals, PNAs, VOCs, PCBs, now dioxins maybe from this site. Have you found a linkage of that to the slough? Is there any indication that impacts the surface water from this site?
I haven't seen information that would lead me to believe there's a source of dioxins at the site. It's not completely characterized for that, for source attribution. But as you know, the whole area around is replete with sites that use penta that was likely contaminated with dioxin. Yeah.
I can't help but notice in one of the more recent aerial photos that there's still structures such as a roundhouse and above ground tank platforms and that kind of stuff in place. In my experience, those things are some of the first things to at least explore as source area control. Are they in fact still in place? Have they been characterized themselves and discounted as being a continued or unknown source here?
Some are still in place. A lot have been removed. One of the things that was proposed in the CIRAP was removal of the foundations, removal of additional structures, in addition to some of the other piles that you see as you look out there. Until they remove the foundations, I'd have a hard time commenting on the characterization of what you'd find underneath of it.
Okay, and from the standpoint of dioxins and furans, not that it's been necessarily linked to this site, but in my experience, dioxins and furans are equilibrated to a 2378 TCDD equivalent. Mm-hmm. When you talk concentrations before, are those in that terms? Are you talking specific dioxins and furans?
Thank you for pointing that out. As you know, the dioxins and furans, and some people include coplanar PCBs, it's a collection of chemicals that have different characteristics and different toxicities. They've been, for the large part, equilibrated to 2378 TCDD, and that's true for, what we're looking at is a toxic equivalent quotient on this, so it is the normalized sum of those substances.
So the number that you stated, that's a TEQ number?
That's a TEQ number,
okay.
Yes.
Does that, assuming that, I don't know if there's a linkage, and I don't want to speculate the linkage of dioxins and furans back to this site, but is the risk assessment then adequate to go down the, this site's going to go down the road to closure at some point, given that, enough work's done here to remediate this site, and I would assume that risk assessment comes into play, at least in the argument and the formulation, along with the site conceptual model to say, mm-hmm. this is the risk of this site and this is the reason why. Is the risk assessment then informing that, given, is it a complete picture, given it's part of the documentation that looks like it's a bit aged at this point?
Well, it is, and those substances, the dioxins and furans, have been found on the site, and so they will have to be addressed not only for human health but also for eco-risk.
I must say that I find it myself unhelpful to have a development time frame that tries to overlap with a cleanup time frame.
Yeah.
It never works. Obviously, this thing's been going for 22 years. I don't know if in the audience the project proponents here, but in my experience, it makes it a lot harder and a lot more expensive to do it that way. You have multimedia out here that's impacted with a variety of contaminants that have rather stringent cleanup levels on many, in many terms. And given the cleanup and abatements order status, it sounds like that, for one, we don't have all the responsible parties identified. And it sounds like, two, that we're linking under the old terms of the cleanup and abatement status a final remedial action plan and implementation thereof within some time frame that's very short on the development schedule. I would suggest, and we're not going to take action on this today, but to think about the fact that, again, that the development time frame does not sync with a cleanup time frame, and it greatly complicates that process, in my experience, in many ways. You mentioned that the revision of a cleanup and abatement order may, in fact, be a process here, and part of that would be, I would hope, to get to a final corrective action plan and implementation thereof, a remedial action plan, to get this site done. That's just my suggestion at this point.
No, I appreciate that comment. Thank you.
Yeah. So with that, I will look on GeoTracker. I did look for it, and I did find some stuff, and I didn't have those two numbers. I'll catch those from you after this. You don't have to put them back up, but I'm interested in this.
Well, if you do even find one of them, I have in the comments section the link to the other, or at least okay. the notation that it's also found on another. And also, as you know, in GeoTracker, there's, you know, sort of spotty older history of having things included. And as people have asked for things to be PDF'd and put on GeoTracker, I've been doing that so it's more accessible to people. So if there's some documents you would like to see that aren't linked, we can do that.
Yeah, it just sounds like this site to me has, you know, these sites are up and down the old railroad lines. You know, they start from the beginning and they dot themselves all the way up the lines. And there's many of them around, and this is yet another one that, you know, given the fact that this is a proposed development at this point with a cleanup site going on, there's really only one way, and it's forward to get this thing done. It's unhelpful to have a contaminated site that is proposed for development, goes through a permitting process, and stalls, or gets complicated because of this type of thing.
Thank you.
Thanks, Karen. I'd like to echo what Mr. Noren said, and maybe not in such technical detail and for his region of expertise, but I think that we have a very good site characterization. Obviously, this has been worked on for a long time, and based on the map and the close to, 200 color-coded dots of trenching and where things have happened, I think that's very well documented. With maybe exception of a little work on the dioxin and just trying to finesse a little bit of the source on that one. And I understand why that's hard to issue a remediation plan when it may unfairly be attributed to one source or another. That being said, I think that, you know, with the old cleanup and abatement order being issued in 2001, obsolete references in there, outdated references in there, getting that brought up to current speed, I think the overall flavor of that is this site just needs to get cleaned up, period. And the mechanism for doing that, it seems like we're streamlining toward doing that, and I appreciate Mr. Noren's suggestion about how to do that, and I think that's a good way to go. Secondly, I would also like to get maybe a little bit more information on what's happening with the Coastal Commission. I know there's been some questions about, and even as we have it summarized in our agenda item, that there's some arguments that they've overstepped their authority. So can I, either from you or perhaps from council, get a little bit more information there on what either the parallel tracks that are happening or how that's meshing? Not to put you right on the spot, but that's one of the things I was hoping to hear a little bit more detail about.
No, that's fine. As Karen was describing, and Kat or Karen, step in if I characterize this wrong. When the interim remedial action plan was given to us, as Karen described, we had said, looks good for dealing with stormwater. You need to get all the permits you need to get, because there was some filling of wetlands that went along with that, some other things that weren't, as Karen described, directly related to the stormwater. So the county, as I understand it, went ahead and issued the permit, and that permit...
City
issued the permit, and that the local... They act as the local coastal...
Right, they had adopted a local coastal plan, and then we're holding proceedings pursuant to that.
Right, so then people have the ability, once that coastal permit is issued, to appeal it to the Coastal Commission, which was done. And when the Coastal Commission looked at it, they wanted some more information about whether this was the least environmentally damaging way to go. The owners of the property, it's my understanding, part of their argument back was that there is a public resources code that says something to the effect of when the regional board or state board makes a water rights or water quality decision, other agencies, well, the Coastal Commission cannot act in conflict with that. Our position, though, is that we understand that there's an independent regulatory requirements of the Coastal Commission and the city, et cetera. So we don't believe there is a conflict with what we were saying and what the Coastal Commission is looking for. So that process right now, as I understand it, the Coastal Commission will have a de novo review, and currently I think they're waiting for more information from the owner. I think, as Karen described, we're sort of ready to move on though, with requesting maybe a new, going ahead with having them enroll under our stormwater, industrial stormwater permit, and then following up with a remedial action plan.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Chair.
Mr. Dunker.
All the responsible parties, what you said has not been all identified yet? Is that?
No, they've been identified. They haven't been listed on the cleanup and abatement order. The cleanup and abatement order still lists the prior owner, Union Pacific.
Okay. The reason I brought that up is, would it have any impact on expediting the cleanup process? But if they're identified, then that shouldn't be a big deal. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Just one coordination question. I understand we had an interim cleanup measure, and then we were going to review on the final Coastal Commission appeal, and I understand coastally dependent use and the other elements of the appeal. One thing I'm not clear on is, are they intending to get into a final remediation plan? And if so, how does that get coordinated with us so we don't have a governmental conflict develop here?
The final remediation plan would go through us. We don't have one yet. As I said, the CIRAP was produced in response to a request for stormwater, but there was a lot of proposed actions in there that also addressed more source remediation, more source removals, in addition to their development plans, too. And so we will see the final remedial action plan. We don't have a date certain yet. We still need some more investigation.
Mr. Corbett, with our intention is, as we move to a final cleanup plan for this site, we would be working very closely with the Coastal Commission.
Okay.
Thanks.
Anybody else? Okay, thanks, Karen.
Thank you.
I